the Pilot TV podcast this week, we're returning to the golden age of Hollywood in Ryan Murphy's Tinseltown series of the same name, getting our Parisian jazz on in Jack Thorne and Damien Chazelle's The Eddie, and ripping off the local circus with Joe Gilgan and his merry band of miscreants in season 2 of Brassic. I'm James Dyer, and welcome to the Pilot TV podcast, a show that has become so obsessively invested in Connell and Marianne's relationship over the past week that we can barely think about anything else. That Jamie A, what a dick. Joining me, as ever, are my two co-hosts. First up, a man who has his own IMDb page with no less than 50 separate entries, one of which is an officially sanctioned acting role in Annually Retentive, where he played someone called Boyd Hilton, while 49 are actually credited for playing himself in the likes of Ooh, You Are Awful, TV we used to love, The Barbara Windsor Story, and Most Annoying People 2010. Let's not forget, of course, 2003's 100 Greatest Sexy Moments. Unfortunately, his breakout performance as Pantstacker in the Gavin and Stacey Christmas special went uncredited. He's a household name in television and has at no point been a historian and fellow of Trinity College like his namesake. It's the second most famous, Boyd Hilton. Hello, Boyd.
Wow. You've done a lot of very sudden research.
Thank you. What was the single greatest sexy moment of 2003? Do you remember?
No, it's all a blur, to be honest. But you'll be pleased you to know that yeah, I've added to my this very morning I did a new Talking Heads show for Channel 5 about Gavin and Stacey. Yeah. And I did a Zoom Talking Head. They're now doing, basically, they're still so desperate for content on TV. They're still doing these shows, and they're doing, all the contributors will be doing it via Zoom, and that's what I did this morning.
And do you update your own IMDb page, or do they do it
no.
for you?
What? I'm not
Do you have people for this?
Fuck no. I don't know. Fuck knows who does it.
I mean, I was just curious, like, because like Wikipedia doesn't let you fuck about with your own page. Mm. Like, it has to be done by others. And I wonder whether IMDb was managed by the people involved, or whether some grand poobah does it.
No, I think some grand poobah. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Christ knows.
Interesting. Joining Boyd and myself is an equally famous personage. She is the author of the upcoming autobiography, Coming Undone, a recent creator of A Small Human, and, like Joe Gilgan's Brassic character, has undoubtedly ripped off a circus at some point in her life. It's Terry White. Hello, Terry.
Hi, James Dyer. I mean, basically, well, it was more, rather than a circus, it was more the travelling fair was the big deal in my time. They used to come into Chesterfield car park and park up, and all the girls would get off with the travelling men. He would spin your waltzes faster if you screamed hysterically.
Is that a euphemism?
No, that's not a euphemism. Right, okay. Because I didn't partake in such a thing, but other girls did. And I think I've told you this before. They used to have Danger Night, which was the first night the fair was active after they'd set it up. And all the prices were 50% off. All the rides were half price, because they were testing them out, and it used to be called Danger Night. And I've asked loads of Southern people if this was a thing down south, and apparently it wasn't.
No. Well, because they're not sure if they've assembled it properly and you could go flying off into the atmosphere. That's
well,
kind of the...
presumably, Danger Night, 50% off, take your life in your hands, off you go.
Is that where all the cool kids went on Danger Night?
Yeah, all the youth went on Danger Night. But I just thought this was a fair thing, a travelling fair custom. But apparently, the more I speak to people and they look at me like you and Boyd just looked at me, the more I figure it's not a thing.
Well, the only fair that I used to go to was Pinner Fair. It was where I grew up, in Pinner. And the fair would come to Pinner once a year. And the only thing I would ever do there is play on the arcade. So I would go there and I would play Street Fighter 2 and stuff like that in the arcade. We do like car washing. Me and my friends would do car washing around the local area in the days leading up to Pinner Fair. So we had some cash to take down. And then we'd go and blow it all on the arcades.
Yeah. That's very sweet.
Yeah,
I have a bit of a fear of fairs. I don't like them at all. I find them really creepy and
what, like Austin Powers, small hands, smell like
cabbage. And just, you know, the Elephant Man, it reminds me of the Elephant Man, all the freaks and all that, you know. I don't like
think
them.
Fairs are like that these days.
It's not
like
Carnivale. It's like
there's not like conjoined twins.
Yeah, but there's like, you say that, but I see a lot of horror implications. Like that episode of Euphoria was a nightmare. I just don't like them.
So you particularly enjoyed that series of American Horror Story then?
Oh, God, I couldn't stand that series. That is by far my least favourite series of American Horror Story. And I like American Horror Story. It totally traumatised me, yeah.
Boyd, have you ever been on a waltzer?
I don't think so, no.
Have you ever been on any fairground ride?
I mean, I've been on yeah, the odd fairground ride, yeah, but I didn't enjoy it. Yeah, found it quite dramatic, all of them. I mean, I've been to Disneyland and Disney World, you know.
So you go to Winter things. Wonderland in Hyde Park at Christmas.
Oh, I have done that, but against my will, I've been dragged there. Yeah, I didn't enjoy
ridiculous.
It.
So we had the Empire Christmas party at Winter Wonderland once, where we all ate turkey in a tent and then did the rides together.
I mean, that sounds horrific.
It really was.
I'm not sure what's more traumatic, that or the thought of a little boy like trapped on a ride, terrified, hating every minute.
Yeah.
Amazing. I remember going there with a friend who had some kids with him, and he was like, oh, you're going to send them a ride. I was like, guys, I was like, not being funny, but this is how almost every other horror film I've seen begins. Just like, what are you doing? Yeah. Sending your kids unaccompanied into the quote unquote fun house. I just think, just don't do it. Don't do it.
Your children are going to die.
Exactly. Have you not seen Us? It doesn't end well. Anyway, enough digression. Let's get straight into what we've been watching. And I'm going to kick this off, as was implied by my introduction, because I have been watching Normal People. And to say I love Normal People would be an understatement. This is my show of the year thus far. It is surpassing The Expanse and Picard, which is saying no small thing. But it's just the most magnificent 12 episodes of television. It is so emotionally turbulent, and their relationship is so raw and real and maddening and just clumsy and believable. And I felt like I experienced every scene of this show with these characters. And God, I went through the ringer. I was a fucking wreck when I finished the final episode of that, an absolute wreck. It just destroyed me. And I think those performances, both of them, were just beyond good, just so good. And I don't know how much of it is down to it. Like I said, I haven't read the book, though I very much now want to. How much it is down to how Sally Rooney drew those characters, but they are so layered and they are so real. Like, they almost feel more real than actual people. Like, it's quite extraordinary. And the layers of emotional baggage that each of them carry, and the fact that, you know, and there's lots of conversation on Twitter when I was talking about this, people say, oh God, no, these two self-destructive people. I was like, no. It's that they both got their issues. Like, for him, it's like crippling shyness and an inability to articulate his emotions. He has EQ problems. With her, it's obviously the toxic families led to her having massive self-esteem problems and self-worth issues. And their inability to communicate is obviously, like so many shows, the crux of all the drama. You know, if they just sat down and actually spoke to each other, everything would be fine. But I thought it was absolutely magnificent, and I can't say enough good things about it.
Well, I am with you because I watched the final 8 in one go on Tuesday. We're recording this on Friday, and I'd been rationing them because I'd been trying to kind of eke it out for as long as possible. Because when I love something, I go full, like, all-you-can-eat buffet, face first in it, gorging until I feel sick. And I was like, I don't want to do that. I want to, like, appreciate each and every episode. And then on Tuesday, it was cobbing it down. It's pretty miserable day. I was like, fuck this. I'm getting into bed with my baby and we're watching 8 episodes of Normal People. And I mean, we talked about it obviously a few weeks ago. And I remember talking about how it wasn't edgy, but it was really lovely and sweet. Mm. But the way it changes as it goes on, Christ almighty, when you watch the entire thing in one go as I did, the way the characters change, all of the stuff you're talking about, James, with her toxic family and what that leads her to do. There's some kind of, you know, dark shit in there. It goes to some really dark places. But it's just, I mean, Daisy Edgar Jones, especially Paul Mescal, who I just think, how has he not been in everything so far? He is extraordinary.
And so much of that performance is internal. Like, so much of it is not what he says, it's what he doesn't say and can't say. And just the contortions of his face, you can see what's going through his mind and his inability to articulate it. And he's a really funny one, because there's that bit where early on, certainly in the first 2 episodes that we saw, and we won't do any plot spoilers, so no one panic, but like you just wanted to slap him around the head. It's like, you lummox, what are you doing? And you get quite irritated by him, and he behaves in ways that not particularly good, but he's got this sort of moral core to him that's sort of rock steady and steadfast, and he's this one constant. And you he's a really, really awesome character. I thought he was magnificent.
But just also as a portrait of being of first love, but also being that age. Like, I absolutely, I was talking about this on Twitter. I hated being a teenager, every single minute of being a teenager. I fucking hated university. I was surrounded by middle-class posh people, none of whom I related to.
I mean, your life hasn't changed that much in that regard, if I'm honest with you. No.
But, you know, I hate it all significantly less now. But it actually, what was so, like, so brilliant about it is, even though I hated all of that stuff in my own life, it was such a beautiful portrait of what that can be, that I had this weird thirst for and tenderness for being a teenager and for being at university that I never had in real life. It was weird because the longing it gave you and the just this sweet, I mean, oh God, I was absolutely bereft when it finished, I have to say. I was just like sat staring at the wall going, what now?
Just honestly, one of the most romantic things I think I've ever seen. Just, it's all the feels, but it makes you sad. It makes you absolutely furious at times, like outrage. And there are so many moments that we obviously can't talk about because this isn't the spoiler special. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to do one for this one. But there are a couple of moments where you are just like, yes, fucking finally, you know?
I would add that I actually think beyond it just being the romantic element you were talking about and the what it deals with, without spoiling it, the in quotes issues, you know, the traumas that various characters have, her fucked up boyfriends, I mean, I'm going to say that with that, that's not a spoiler, in general, no. Those fucking bellends, so brilliantly portrayed, I have to say. But I think I finished it and I thought, actually, the other, just generally about human interrelationships, like miscommunication. It's brilliant on miscommunication, isn't it? And on people getting the wrong understanding. And I think that doesn't go just for, like, you know, teenagers. I think that goes through life. I'm like sitting there thinking, oh my God, well, this can really teach people about not to fall into certain traps, about making assumptions.
Of communication.
Yeah, the importance of honesty and communication, and just not falling into the trap of assuming what the other person is thinking about you. Mm. It's so clever on that. And it's so, the observations of that are so brilliant. It's like, you know, when observations are made about everyday life, you know, like, wow, I can't believe no one's ever said this before. I feel like that about it. It's like, I don't feel any, and I think that must be what everyone loved about the book, is that she somehow pinpoints how these things work and the complexities of managing to get to the truth of things between two people. It's so brilliantly done, yeah. So I completely agree. And I also finished, I think I finished it at 2 or 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
Everyone's been going on about, I think I wanted to mention Hetty McDonald, because she directed the whole of the second half of it.
Mm.
And she did a brilliant job. I mean,
it's,
I agree totally about it.
Beautifully directed.
Yeah.
Some of the shots are stunning.
Looks incredible. The intimacy. I talked about the huge close-ups. Like, I've never seen such huge close-ups. It works so well.
Also, the equality of the nudity, I thought, you know, props to them for that.
Yeah.
That while, admittedly, Daisy Edgerton spends a lot of it topless, but they do say, you know what, turnabout's fair play, get your knob out, you know, and I think that's fair.
And I love it so much, and I agree, I think it's also one of my favourite, I would say this and Devs are my favourites of the year. I love it so much that when I've seen people nitpicking about it, steady Terry, Dave just put a tongue out, thanks. When I see people nitpicking about Normal People, it's getting to the point where there's going to be a think piece, isn't there, in The Guardian probably saying, oh why?
God.
And I've seen people saying there are too many sex scenes. I've seen people saying it's slow. I'm like, you are fucked up because 100%. It is slow. If you stand back and think about it, sometimes things do take quite a long time, but that's the whole point of it. It lives and breathes its own pace brilliantly. And I think the sex scenes, as I said when we first reviewed, I think they're so incredible and brilliantly done that it's key. They're key to the whole thing, aren't they?
No, but I saw somebody moaning that it was longer than The Irishman. So they were I've added it up and it's longer than The Irishman. I'm like, I don't even fucking know what that comparison is meant to mean.
But
it's nothing meaningful.
There wasn't one minute of this show that I was bored. Like, not one minute. I was drawn in, engaged, riveted from start to finish of it. And it's funny because this is obviously a lot of people doing this. The glorious Sarah Phelps. So it's one evening I was watching it and I was looking on Twitter afterwards and I just saw her tweeting someone, oh, shut up, Jamie, you turd. Hashtag normal people. And I was like, yes, yes, indeed. And also just big shout out to Sarah Green because Lorraine is my god. I thought Lorraine was the most amazing character.
Incredible.
She's brilliant.
Backing up your point on direction, Boyd, like what I loved about Hetty's episodes is there was obviously there was shared DNA and it was part of the same thing, but it also looked different enough that she was making it her own thing. So the first episode she directed, the opening scene was this kind of face off between the two of them and across the cafe table, and it you instantly knew it was a different director. But they were both so brilliant. But hers had a real mark of her work and his had a mark of his. And I thought that took kind of real confidence, actually, to allow them to both express it in their own ways, especially when the first six episodes are so amazing.
Yeah.
That when that shift comes, but they were all just incredible.
I think the first half has a slightly more like realist tone to it. And I think the second half is a slightly more poetic tone. That's what I was thinking. But you're right. It does completely work. I was going to say the good news is they are doing, of course, Sally Rooney's first book. So that's we can look forward to that.
Conversations with friends.
So, I mean, yeah.
Because everyone's demanding, like, can we get a season two of Normal People? And there's a part of me that I would almost give anything to spend more time with these characters. But equally, I just think you kind of can't do that. Like, this is a story that needs to be now left alone, lest it be ruined. But,
Yeah, and the ending, without us giving anything away, it's a very specific, you know, deliberately chosen ending. And it would feel really, really odd for them to kind of go on from the book in a Handmaid's Tale way and create a whole new narrative, because whether you agree or disagree with the ending, it's kind of a perfect ending in many respects, and it would be hard to see that undone.
I agree.
Yeah.
Normal People, available now on iPlayer or Hulu in the States. So what else have you guys been watching?
Season 3 of Line of Duty.
Terry's rewatch. Now we've finished my Battlestar Galactica. Now this is Terry's Line of Duty rewatch.
This is my Battlestar Galactica. I'm watching a season a week at the moment, which shows you how much time I have on my hands in the middle of the night. And this is the Daniel Mays season, dealing with historic child abuse and the kind of wider criminal outfit that have been looming over it since season one. Oh my god, it's so good. And every time I start a new season, I'm like, I'm not sure about this. I really think the last season was better. And then I'm drawn in within about 13 seconds. So season 4 starts tomorrow, guys.
Yeah.
Woo.
And sooner or later you'll get to the point when there is a UCO inside the OCG. Oh, love that show so much. Boyd, what have you been rewatching, perhaps?
No, I don't rewatch. But I finished Blood. So Blood, which we reviewed last week, and I think I just to reiterate how great it was. I think Sophie Petzl just did a brilliant job with that, because it just twisted and turned, and it wasn't even. Sometimes it was just like a relationship drama, you know, and the thriller element would kind of fade into the back, and then it'd come back in again. But it just had an incredibly resiliently compelling undercurrent of thriller, but loads and loads of brilliant stuff on top of that, just about the interrelationships with this unbelievably fucked up family, and everyone in it just absolutely brilliant. You know, everyone perfectly cast. So I thought that was fantastic, and loved finishing that. And I just want to mention really Schitt's Creek, which I think I've mentioned it before, and it's season 6, which is the last season, arrives on Netflix, I think in about a week's time, and all 5 seasons are there at the moment. And it's a show that when I first started watching it, I was like, I'm not sure, I don't think it's that funny, I don't think it's that great. It's created by David Levy and his dad Eugene Levy, and it's got Catherine O'Hara in it, and it's got that kind of quality of those Christopher Guest films, you know, all the great Christopher Guest films. That's the tone, but slightly camper in a way, and slightly more sitcom-y. But the more you watch it, the funnier it gets, the more you love the characters. I'm now deep into it. I'm like in up to season 3, and I'm really loving it. And it's perfect to kind of take your mind off any misery you've got. It's so kind of, there's just something brilliantly uplifting about it. It's great. Schitt's
now,
Creek.
Am I
the
right
Netflix.
In saying that this is one of those comedies that took a while to get good?
Yeah.
Because I watched say, the pilot of this and immediately was like, no.
Yeah. I would say you could even skip season 1, start season 2, because season 2 is a lot better, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Parks and Recreation syndrome. I get it.
Yeah, a bit. Yeah, definitely. And it gets better and better and better as it goes on.
Okay. Well, that is what we've been watching. Time now for a listener question. And this week's question comes from Adam Avery, who asks, if this current situation lasted for a whole year and you could only keep three shows on each streaming platform, what would they be? Now, obviously, this is kind of like, what are each of your three favorite shows on the various streaming platforms? But the way I've interpreted this is they have to be things that are ongoing. They can't be old things. Now, that's just the way I've interpreted you. Your mileage may vary, but that was my take on this.
Also, yeah, you just decided that. You didn't tell us that before.
Well, I don't know. It just felt like if you're keeping three shows on each streaming platform, it just feels like, you know, it should be current stuff rather than what they've got. Because with Netflix, it's a little bit unpredictable. Is it Netflix this month? Is it Netflix last year when they had the rights to, you know, Friends? So...
No.
Anyway, who wants to go first?
My interpretation was, I thought I'm just do my... My interpretation was kind of like, I've stuck to roughly things that premiered on each of these platforms rather than old stuff. So that's my kind of general justification. And mine are incredibly predictable. I haven't really thought that. But I just was honestly, these are genuinely my answers to the question. So Apple TV Plus, it's got to be Servant, M. Night Shyamalan series, which I loved. And I did rewatch a few of those just to remind me how brilliant it was. And it's fucking awesome. It's so meticulously directed. The atmosphere is so brilliant in it that so all of these repay reviewing for me. The Morning Show, which we all loved and got better and better and better. And I can't wait for the second season of that. And Trying, which we reviewed last week, and I finished because I hadn't watched the final episode. The final episode is wonderful, of Trying, with Rafe Spall that we reviewed last week. Amazon Prime, I've gone for Transparent, which I think was their best thing for a long, long time. I hated the finale, the stupid feature-length finale they did, the musical, which I thought was a terrible disgrace. But up until that point, all the rest of the series were really good. I know it's a bit weird watching it because the main star, was part of the Me Too investigation, and it all became very dodgy and unpleasant. But the show itself was really, really good—an exploration of a trans woman who's a senior citizen who discovers that element to them, or is suddenly lets that element come out. And it's also a study of a kind of Californian kooky Jewish family as well. There's a whole thing about when they go to Israel, etc. That was a brilliant series. And I've gone for Homecoming, which I loved, which season two arrives soon. And I loved that with Julia Roberts. I thought that was brilliantly directed. It was like a Brian De Palma tribute series, which is perfect for me. And Mr. Robot, which I've got to go back to, which all four seasons are on Amazon. And I think that's one of the best shows that we haven't really paid much attention to on this particular podcast. So I'm going to watch that.
That's their own fault because they didn't show us the final season in time for us to review it.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, it's totally their fault. And finally, Netflix, Better Call Saul, which we talked about last week. Afterlife, just about winning over Sex Education, because I think Afterlife I can watch again and again and again for the rest of time. And, of course, The OA.
The OA.
What more needs to be said?
Oh, yes.
I could rewatch The OA every few months for the rest of time.
And somewhere in the multiverse, a Boyd Hilton is.
Yeah.
Terry, how about yours?
Okay, so I slightly changed the rules myself after shouting at you, because I decided I don't want anything from Amazon Prime, and I'm going to substitute Amazon Prime for the BBC iPlayer, because
amazing.
I have watched more things on BBC iPlayer in the last 2 months than I have pretty much in my entire life. I've rinsed my license fee about 10 times over. But we'll start with Apple TV Plus, which I've only chosen two for, by the way, because I think only two are worthy of actually watching over and over again, which are Servant and The Morning Show, which obviously are also what Boyd chose. Netflix, I've just gone full rogue and gone anything on Netflix. It doesn't matter where it originated from or where it premiered. So Afterlife, Gavin and Stacey, which is now all on Netflix, and One of Us, which is a documentary feature film about a Hasidic Jew community and a woman who leaves that community and what happens to her fight for her children. It's kind of a companion piece in some respects to Unorthodox, sorry. And then on BBC iPlayer, you won't be surprised to hear that it's Line of Duty, because I need to keep watching it for the rest of time. Normal People, because of what we've just spoken about. But then also Killing Eve, because I watched the third episode of Killing Eve. I'm not watching it. We get access to previews. I'm trying not to watch it like that. I'm trying to watch it episodically, like it's being intended to be. We talked about how we were quite disappointed by the first couple of episodes, and I felt really disappointed. The third episode for me is a real kind of return to form. Not completely, but it had so much more of the kind of set pieces and the writing and the surprises that we'd come to expect from it. So I'm kind of back into Killing Eve now, and I'm excited for episode 4 this Sunday. So those are my three from iPlayer, and thank you, none from Amazon.
Wow. Poor Amazon. See, now I feel, oh, I almost want to redo everything, because for some reason, when we discussed this, I thought, well, okay, if you can only keep three shows on an ongoing basis, in my head, I just thought, oh, well, so this is going to be new stuff. Because otherwise, I'd be like, well, so then it's going to just be Sky / Now TV so that I can have Game of Thrones and The Wire and all of that great HBO stuff. So, no, my interpretation of this is shows that are ongoing and new seasons and new episodes of which are coming. So nothing that has ended fell into mine. So,
I enjoy your deeply pragmatic approach to this massively hypothetical, not real world question.
Yeah,
well, I've taken it very
seriously. Specific reinterpretation, by the way.
So for Netflix, for me, it was Sex Education, The Last Kingdom, and Star Trek Discovery. So these are, for me, the greatest things on Netflix that are currently ongoing. I will accept no substitutes. Okay. On Amazon, and I had loads on Amazon, I struggled to condense it to three on Amazon, Terry White. For me, Amazon, obviously, at number one, The Expanse. And also Picard. So The Expanse and Picard are up there for number one. So The Expanse, Picard, and then I had to pick between The Boys and Bosch. And I struggled with that and ultimately went with Bosch. So Bosch is my third choice for Amazon. Disney Plus is something which is technically a streaming service that neither of you have taken into account, but they only have The Mandalorian, so really, you know.
Wait a minute, but the question was specifically about the other streaming services.
I think there were more exemplars, weren't they? I don't think he was being restrictive.
You could do every streaming service known to fucking man if you wanted
also,
to.
Says exemplars? More to the point.
This question, you have completely just rewritten the question.
Anyway, I've also included Sky Now TV.
Oh my god.
What? Now TV streaming service, and because I wanted to put Save Me on there, and I couldn't really.
You're just naming the best shows ever now. What's the difference? Everything's on a streaming
service.
Because
it's stuff that's ongoing. See, this is why I felt I needed to limit myself.
Yeah, but that's not his question.
Yes,
you've also got limiting yourself.
Limiting myself. So
that
Little Lies is kind of not technically ongoing, is it? Like it's unclear whether that's coming back, isn't it? So I wasn't sure whether I could include that.
I mean, you're just literally listing your favourite programme.
No, I am not.
Yes, you are.
Stop it. We've always doing that again. Game of Thrones will be on here and it isn't, so that is
and
my
I hope
defense.
Everyone's enjoying this 7-hour podcast, by the way.
Yes, and Apple, you're both wrong, because yes, Servant and the Morning Show should be on there, but neither of which measure up to
C.
The glory of C.
Don't say C.
Which is
don't
my number
C.
One Apple show.
No.
Which I could, I mean, re-watch. I'm not sure watch is the operative word, but I could re-experience. Yes, C. Marvellous.
Is this because there's a person with it in one eye who masturbates?
I mean, she doesn't have one eye. She's blind. Okay. But as is everyone except for the kids and, you know, Jala Morel. But anyway, yes, I think, Adam, this should in some way have answered your question, I hope. If you wish to have your question addressed on the podcast, then please DM it to us at Pilot TV Mag on Twitter, or feel free to fling it at me directly. But if you're going to do that, again, I strongly suggest you do it at some point on a Wednesday. Otherwise, I will just forget about it by the time it's time to do the podcast.
Be among the first to experience Ardent Community's newest luxury apartments in Galloway, Ohio, the Pinnacle and the Reserve at Parkside Village. Enjoy spacious modern floor plans designed for comfort, style, and convenience. Amenities built around your lifestyle, beautiful finishes, thoughtful community spaces, and the perfect location. Move in now and live rent-free for 2 full months. Start fresh in a place that truly feels like home. The Pinnacle and the Reserve at Parkside Village. Call or visit ardentcommunities.com to schedule a tour or check out our rent specials.
Right, shall we, at this point, move on to the world of news? And we should begin this week, I think, Terry, with some news about your favourite person, and I think all of ours to a certain extent, Stephen Graham, who, it has been announced, is joining Peaky Blinders Season 6.
Hmm. How is he not already in Peaky Blinders? No.
You ask an excellent question.
That's like the most obvious, brilliant bit of casting ever. I thought he was already in it and had been for a long time.
You just assumed he was a Peaky Blinder. Yeah.
Yes.
We don't know what part he's playing, but he was, he was set to join, obviously, before production kind of halted. And now he will be picking up as soon as it comes off hold. So that's very exciting. Stephen Graham, Peaky Blinder.
Can I mention the Fresh Prince reunion?
Did
we see this online?
I didn't see it.
So Will Smith's got this online show called Will From Home, and he got all of the cast pretty much back together to have this reunion where they kind of shared memories and talked about specific things. But the loveliest bit was there's a kind of a tribute to Uncle Phil, James Avery, who obviously is no longer with us. But it was so lovely. And obviously everybody's kind of doing these at-home things, some of which work better than others. But I've just found it, you know, 13-year-old Terry was very much enjoying it and found it really touching and emotional. Boy, did you see any of that online, seeing as you're on the internet and James isn't?
I did see that it happened, yeah, but I haven't actually, I haven't watched it. But no, I'm excited by the prospect of it, yeah, completely, yeah. There's also the Parks and Rec reunion happening as well this week.
Indeed, which a got COVID everyone, special.
Yeah, which the American reviews have been amazing. Everyone's saying it was really nice and wonderful, and no confirmation if it's going to be shown here. It's all on Sky Comedy, Parks and Rec. I don't know if they've got the rights to show this new episode, but yeah.
So where did it air in the States?
On whichever channel normally shows it.
Yeah, so it wasn't an online thing. It was specifically broadcast.
Yeah, I think it was broadcast. Yeah, I believe.
You got to think it's going to come here. Surely sure. It'll come over here or go online somewhere.
Yeah, you'd think, wouldn't you? Yeah.
You would hope. Some other exciting news? Well, in my world, anyway, Terry Pratchett's Discworld novels are being adapted en masse. So
I saw this on the internet and I was like, I am not going to talk about this and I'm going to let James get very excited by this. Well,
the thing is, it's a bittersweet thing. So there's a sort of city watch series that's been in development for a while. That's been I think it's an 8-part series that the BBC America has been doing. So it's all the stories other than that. But the thing is that Discworld has had a bit of a spotted history. Sky have done a few of them. They've done Hogfather and a couple of others, I think. And they've been, shall we say, a bit hit and miss. And I think part of that, we talked about this on the Empire podcast a little bit. I think part of that is a budgetary issue because they feel a bit cheap. But I also think the problem with Discworld, and again, I've also talked about this on Empire, but I think the problem with Discworld is what's good about them isn't the stories or really anything that easily translate to screen. What's good about them is the Terry-ness of it, the Pratchett narration with his footnotes and his particular quirky sense of humor, turns of phrase and observations that I can't really get my head around quite how you bring that to life on the screen. So while I think it's great that they're doing this and I hope they do a good job with it, I just wonder whether these are books that it's even possible to adapt, because it's impossible to get that, you know, that narrator's voice, that omnipresent narrator's voice in there. But who knows? We'll see. It's being overseen by Rhiannon Pratchett, which is his daughter. So I imagine that they will be done faithfully and well. But we'll see. And no doubt it'll be another Good Omens thing where I'll love them and you two will hate them.
I liked Good Omens in the end.
Oh, did you?
I think we all kind of quite liked it, right?
Hang on. We're not retconning history here. I firmly recall Terry White, the accused, as describing it as insufferably smug, much like myself. thereby explaining in your brain why I liked it.
I don't remember saying that, but it sounds entirely like something I'd say.
Yeah, I didn't like the first episode, but I watched more of it and I liked it and I finished it and it was better.
Oh yeah, I didn't like it. No, it's terrible. Yeah. sorry, I totally forgot.
What channel is doing these Discworld things, by the way?
You ask a good question. No. I don't know we know. I just know that they're...
Yeah, fine. I don't think it's...
Yeah,
been,
I don't think they've announced produced, that. Right, okay. Yeah, I don't think they've announced
Parks and Rec was on NBC, by the way.
Okay, okay. Good to know.
Did you see the thing about Talking Heads, the Alan Bennett remake? I'm excited about this because Talking Heads, Alan Bennett wrote these monologues in the 80s and 90s. He kind of did one series in the 80s and another series in the 90s, and they were brilliant textbook Alan Bennett observations of normal people living their lives, talking to camera. And they were absolutely amazing, and I loved them. And they're going to do a whole new lot with 10 of the originals remade and 2 new ones that he wrote last year. And the casting is incredible. So you've got Jodie Comer, Monica Dolan, Martin Freeman, Tamsin Gregg, Sarah Lancashire, Leslie Manville, Lucien Massimati, Maxine Peake, Roshenda Sandow, Kristin Scott Thomas, Imelda Staunton, Harriet Walter. So it's like an incredible array of brilliant people doing each one. Now, I've seen, so I'm excited about that. It's going to be on BBC soon, filmed, obviously. It's kind of what completely makes sense to make these in social distancing times. I have seen people complaining about it online. A lot of actors, funnily enough, I've seen a lot of actors kind of complaining that, you know, this was a chance for the BBC to give these roles to young up-and-coming people who need the money, blah, blah, blah. And I can see what they mean by that. But I have to say, for the viewer, from a viewer's point of view, I just feel you want to see these Alan Bennett things performed by these legendary actors. So I think if I hadn't seen young actors complaining about it, and I completely see it must be frustrating for them, I'm very excited by this lineup of actors doing this material.
But why should it automatically be kind of cast with young up-and-coming actors? I don't understand that.
I agree. I think they're just saying, you know, this, or even a chance to cast less famous people. I don't know. I see that frustration a lot from actors generally about stuff, you know, that, you know, and they were saying maybe, you know, at this point in time, it was just a chance to do that. I just don't think that's what this particular project is about, you know, and yeah. I mean, I'm all into things being commissioned and like Normal People, finding him to do that role, yeah. That's brilliant. A complete newcomer who's fucking legendary in that role, yeah. But I think this project needs these legendary people in it. That's my feeling.
Did you see that Netflix have cancelled Turn Up Charlie after one season? Not a great loss.
That was terrible.
Yeah, I did not enjoy it, it can be said.
I think that was one of the worst things we've ever reviewed on this show.
Wow!
It was awful, yeah.
Boyd going big.
Yeah. Scorched Earth.
Couldn't stand it.
What else is happening? Alex Kurtzman of Star Trek fame is adapting a book called The Girl Who Could Move Shit With Her Mind, which I would imagine is kind of self-explanatory.
Specifically shit.
Not a lot of... It's not like, you know, like fecokinesis. I don't think it's specifically that. I think she can move all sorts of things. But it's based on a novel, and the main character is called Tegan Frost, who sounds like some kind of secret agent. But anyway, she has telekinetic powers, and the government capitalizes on that by sending her on missions that no ordinary person could do.
If they've got any sense, they'll rename it to Fecal Kinesis, though, which is a much better title.
Oh, my God.
Let's hope. Okay, super. That was news.
Wait a minute.
There's more news.
Two more things, quickly. Netflix is reviving Borgen, you know, which was a brilliant Danish political thriller series.
Yes, supposed to be very good.
Yeah, with Sidse Babek Knudsen. So they're doing a full series of that, which will go out in 2022, which is very exciting if you're a fan of Borgen. And then they're showing all the other series. But also, I know that this is not traditional Pilot TV podcast territory, but I have to mention the greatest commission of recent years, which is the Monkey Tennis of our times. Have you heard about this show? Channel 4 has commissioned a show called Snoop Dogs, which is basically through the keyhole. Cameras will go into famous people's homes and film around them, and we have to guess which the famous owner is of the homes. And it's all being filmed on GoPro cameras attached to their dogs.
But that is literally through the keyhole with dogs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like
filmed by the dogs.
Through the dog hole.
Through the dog hole, aka Snoop Dogs. It's coming to Channel 4 soon.
That is Monkey Tennis.
If this was on Netflix, not Channel 4, it would have just been Snoop Dogging and have a very different kind of narrative thrust. But hey-ho. Okay, great. Any other dog-related news you'd like to share?
No, I had to get that. I had to mention that.
I really want to watch that, though.
Yeah, same.
Snoop Dogs. Fucking hell.
Amazing.
Okay, super. Now on to this week's reviews. And first up this week, we have Netflix's The Eddie. This is a story of Elliot Udo, a jazz musician and owner of a failing jazz club in Paris. Written by Jack Thorne and directed by Damien Chazelle, it's in a mixture of French and English and will very much make you wish you could play the piano. Terry, did this strike the right note with you?
Oh, I thought you were going to make a Tinkle My Ivories.
Beg your pardon. This is not that kind of podcast, Terry.
Can't believe you let that one bash you by. So, you hear Damien Chazelle, you hear jazz, you hear Paris, and you probably have things in your mind that this show is definitely not. So it's not the cinematic landscape of Paris. It's not all cafes and white people drinking wine by the Eiffel Tower and glamour and glitz. It's dark and it's gritty and it's kind of brutal. There's no kind of sweeping vistas of La La Land. It's handheld, which really kind of sets the tone, I think, for this show. It's really kind of frantic and chaotic, almost documentary style. And as you say, it centers around this jazz club, the Eddie. Andre Holland is the club owner, co-owner, who's this piano legend who used to live in New York, who'd fled to Paris after some kind of unnamed tragedy. It becomes clear his club is in massive financial trouble, and his co-owner, Farid, played by Taha Rahim, has become involved with this local crime outfit. Now, there's this massive kind of multicultural assorted cast of other characters, because this is a really different view of Paris than we've seen before. There's a lot of focus on North African communities. It's a really interesting representation, I think, of what modern day Paris is. Now, when it comes to the other characters, we have to kind of, I think, call out Amanda Stenberg, who plays his daughter, his 16-year-old daughter, who pitches up in New York, has been dispatched there because she's clearly a massive fucking handful, which she is. But she is remarkable. And you know, she's done a couple of films, but she's still incredibly young. But she really comes into her own in episode two. I've seen the first two. Each one focuses on a different character. And episode two for me is fantastic, which really focuses around her and kind of she starts to unravel a little bit when she arrives in the city to live with her dad. The other main character really is the songs. And it was actually the whole thing reverse engineered from these set of songs by producer Glenn Ballard, who did Jagged Little Pill and Man in the Mirror. Which may not seem like the most natural fit for a whole new load of jazz classics. But it's clear that the whole thing kind of centres around this. You know, the whole thing opens on this 5-minute one shot, which takes you from the back room of the club right through into this incredible performance that's happening. And sometimes, I suppose my one criticism of it would be is sometimes it feels like some of the storytelling is coming second to some of these incredible musical set pieces, which are great, but there is a huge focus on them. I mean, the filmmaking team is extraordinary. As you mentioned, Damien Chazelle, he exec produces, he directs the first two episodes. It's all written or co-written by Jack Thorne, who we talk about a lot on this podcast, Virtues, his Dark Materials, This Is England. And I've seen some criticisms of it online for being too dour. And I think that's like, I mean, it is. It's like, it's not an easy watch at times. It's kind of, it's not, there's not much fun, right? You go, as I said earlier, you go jazz, you go Paris, you're expecting this kind of jaunty kind of, it's not that. And I think that's going to be the biggest shift for people is that's not what you're getting. But I really enjoyed it. There's this kind of fantasy family drama rubbing up against this kind of thriller crime story going on in the background. I'm really interested to see how it unfolds because it does focus on a different character each episode, and I think you probably do have to see it as an entire piece. But I'm gonna keep going with this one because, as I say, the first episode is quite a scene setter. There is a big kind of twist in the middle, which we won't spoil. But for me, it really starts to get into the interesting character work in the second episode. And I'm really looking forward to seeing what the rest of them bring afterwards.
It's not a lull fest. I'll certainly give you that.
It's not a lull fest.
What I particularly enjoy about this is because it's not, because in English and French, it has compulsory subtitles on the screen, but they're essentially hard of hearing subtitles. So you have wonderful subtitles like mid-tempo funky rhythm will come up. And you're like, oh, thank you. Thank you for that very specific bit of subtitling. So the ones to accompany the music, I find are just, they're beautifully, beautifully specific. Yeah, but this is not what I thought it would be at all. It took me by surprise. I enjoyed it a lot more. I found it a lot more compelling than I thought I would. It's really well written. It's really well acted. Andre Holland is great in this. And I found myself being drawn into this world. But also, the music is amazing. And just when you see him sort of tinkering around on the piano, and obviously it helps if you like jazz, but absolutely beautiful. And there are just scenes, a couple of them, where he's just noodling around with the keyboard and then someone will do a bit of vocals, someone will whip out a trumpet, and it's a bit like, this is great. You can understand how people might want to spend their days just like jazzing out on this. It was exactly what you said. It's not the Paris that we're used to seeing on screen. It was a kind of grubby back alley Paris, and it wasn't glitzy or glamorous or beautiful. But yeah, I enjoyed this a lot.
Well, I had a weird experience with this because I watched the first episode quite a long time ago for Pilot TV magazine purposes, and I actually found it quite difficult to get along with it. I mean, I am not a jazz person, I have to say. I fucking hate jazz, right? I get out.
We may have hit upon the problem here, Boyd.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, okay, I'm going to give it a go. There is a lot of jazz in it.
So this is Boyd's note that there's not enough dubstep. That's
yeah. I mean, and the
too
scenes where
jazz.
A hell of a lot of jazz. And I was like, oh, I'm not sure if I'm going to, but because I love Jack Thorne, I like, you know, James is obviously a huge talent, et cetera, et cetera. Great cast. I thought, I've got to carry on. Then I watched the second episode much more recently. And the second episode is fantastic, I thought. And because of her, the teenage daughter, Amanda Stenberg, is fantastic. And and there are moments of levity more, I think, in that second episode when she meets this young guy who's brilliant as well. This really likable guy who delivers sandwiches to offices. And I thought that was great because we have a sandwich person coming around. Oh no, he sells brownies in our office when we used to have an office to go to.
The brownie man.
And he reminded me of him. I thought it was really quite well observed little thing that, you know, what is the kind of person who's decided to deliver their own food to offices anyway? I thought episode two was fantastic, and so now I'm in. And there are scenes, like there's a scene in the second episode where they're doing a bit of jazz and he gets frustrated and they all start arguing about the jazz. And I'm like, I'm still don't necessarily, that's just not for me. But I really like the characters. And I really like, and the way it's done, the realism of it, the authenticity of it is incredible, isn't it? It's like handheld 16mm. Yeah. And of course, Damien Chazelle's first film, the drumming one, what was that called?
Whiplash,
thank you. It's more like that, isn't it? Like, people forget, because La La Land is such a big thing, which I didn't really like La La Land either. This is more Whiplash than La La Land. And I think Whiplash was a great film, and that it's got that authenticity, and it feels like it's immersed in this world, and it feels completely real. And yet, you know, the drama of it is obviously brilliantly written by Jack Thorne. So yeah, I'm in, despite my jazz hatred.
Disparaging La La Land is a capital offence in Terry Land. Just be aware of that.
Oh, I can't stand it.
What the fuck, Boyd?
Sorry.
He's got no soul, sorry. Boyd. La La Land is great.
I have. I just didn't like that thing.
Oh, fair enough.
One from the Heart. You know, Francis Ford Coppola's One from the Heart. That's the film that La La Land, without wanting to be a twat, is trying to be.
Oh, I much prefer that. City of stars, are they shining there for you?
Oh, it felt like I was
How
there for a second.
How does that not fill your heart?
Yes, the way you sing it, it's extraordinary. Yes, indeed. Oh. All right, fine. So, depending on whether or not you prefer jazz or dubstep, may in fact determine whether or not you like the Eddie. But the Eddie does in fact land on Netflix on Friday, the 8th of May. Next up this week is Ryan Murphy's Hollywood, which actually dropped on Netflix last week, but which we were unable to review due to a tricky embargo. However, far be it from us to let a show like this pass us by, so our belated review arrives in your ears now instead. This follows a group of aspiring actors trying to make it big in 1940s Hollywood. So let's hear what Boyd has to say about it in Boydie Goes to Hollywood.
Thank you. That's brilliant.
Thank you.
This is another really weird one. So I watched the first two of these a while ago as well. And I thought I rather liked them. I thought, you know, this is Ryan Murphy and his collaborator Ian Brennan working on, in a kind of like in the same world as Feud, their series about Bette Davis and Joan Crawford, which I loved. That was a fantastic series, looking behind the glitz and the glamour of Hollywood, showing you these iconic stars, how bitter and twisted they were. And the first two episodes of this series, which is set in post-war Hollywood period, in the golden age, and it's doing that. It's taking you behind the scenes of the glitz and the glamour. It's showing you that there was this, essentially this gigolo rent boy prostitution racket run out of a gas station in Hollywood where people used to go. So rich wives of Hollywood studio bosses would go there to pick up young men and have sex with them and pay for it. Gay guys would meet via this system as well. And this is all happened. This is all true, by the way. This did happen, that there was a gigolo rent boy gas station place in Hollywood in the 50s and 60s, incredibly. It shows you the kind of abusive exploitation of young stars by the people in power, which was really interesting. Again, obviously happened. Jim Parsons plays this agent, a real life agent to the stars, who was Rock Hudson's agent, who literally is, you know, forcing them to give him oral sex, basically, in return for taking them on as his clients. And all of this, I'm thinking, this is fascinating. This is really interesting. You know, I love this stuff about behind the scenes in Hollywood. Then, I've now watched 6 of the 7 episodes, suddenly it becomes clear that the agenda of the premise of this whole thing is actually that what would happen if we imagined that this group of young, talented, ethnic minority, Jewish, gay people didn't have to overcame the bigotry, the inherent sexism, racism, homophobia of that time, and became successful and got to do creatively what they wanted to do and somehow bypass all the nastiness and horribleness and bigotry that obviously existed and became successful. So it's an alternate history is what it is, but by stealth, because that's not really clear until you get into 3rd, 4th, 5th episodes. But then you're in this really weird situation of it's got loads of real historic characters. George Cukor's famous gay orgy parties, pool parties, crop up in episode 3. They really happened, by the way. And then you've got other things that didn't happen. So then I'm constantly trying to work out what was real, what wasn't real. Why were there maybe a black writer who was trying to come up with a biography of the woman who threw herself off the Hollywood sign? And you're like, it's so confusing as to what real and isn't that in the end, you just have to kind of give up. But I have to say, it becomes less and less interesting the more the fantasy, it is a fantasy element, comes through in these later episodes. So there's still brilliant moments like, the character's based on, you know, people in Gone with the Wind, and there's amazing moments. There's like camp moments that you'd expect about this ridiculousness of Hollywood. It's beautifully done. The costumes and hair and the depiction of this era is fantastic. It's incredibly well filmed and all of that. But it gets weird and like pointless, I think. What is weird about it is it's doing alternate history in the same way that, you know, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood ends up changing history for a very specific reason. And why, you know, the same, you get alternate histories in science fiction shows like The Man in the High Castle. But unlike those, which have very specific points to make and are very clear, it's very clear for everyone involved what did or didn't happen. This is very murky and confusing, I found it anyway. And it's making a rather glib point in the end about this prejudice that existed. And I would just rather have seen a drama about those people, about George Cukor's weird parties and the exploitative agent and what that meant and how that was dealt with, than this thing, which is a weird hybrid thing that just doesn't, in the end, just doesn't really come together and work.
It's strange, isn't it? I had to read around to figure out that it was an alternate history because it's not really pitched as one. It's not, no, that's not, attention isn't drawn to that. I didn't know quite what to make of this because the tone is very bizarre. Like, it's really whimsical and heightened and has an almost sort of dreamlike quality to it. It's not quite surreal, but it feels sort of hyperreal. It's very, very strange. It almost feels like you're watching like an old sort of almost like 1940s production, just in the way that it's that heightened reality and its heightened performances. And the first episode largely revolves around a bunch of gigolos working at a gas station, which, again, not necessarily something I was entirely expecting. But I found it strangely compelling. Do you know what I mean? I didn't know what to expect from it. I wasn't even quite sure what it was trying to do, but I couldn't quite tear my eyes off it either. It's a really, really strange one.
It is bizarre. I agree. I'm carrying on watching it, and I will finish it. 7 episodes. But I just find it frustrating. I don't want to be those critics who kind of tell creative people what they should have done with something. Do you know what I mean? That is almost an intrinsically stupid thing to do. Who am I to tell Ryan Murphy that he's fucked this up and he should have just, you know, done what he did with you? But I do feel that way. I'm sorry. I just feel, and I feel like someone at some point should have just gone, yeah, but why don't you just show us this drama about all these real life people and what really they were like and what really happened? Because that's fascinating. I just didn't need the alternate history element of it.
But isn't that kind of the essence of the problem with creators doing things like Netflix, for example, where there's a lot of talk given about how the likes of Netflix and Amazon Prime, they don't interfere in the way that traditional networks have interfered. But this struck me as something where somebody from a network could have given some really good notes and said, yeah, oh, maybe this premise doesn't really work or this bit doesn't. I mean, the problem I had was I really enjoyed Feud as well, but that was because that had kind of edge and bite and something to say. And even in the first two episodes where it's kind of meant to be sketching out this structural inequality, you know, this kind of dark underbelly of what really went on in Hollywood, it kind of was done in such a whimsical way, as James said about the tone, that you don't really feel like, even though it's patently unfair, you don't feel like anyone's getting harmed by it. You know, the gigolos are kind of are running around, like the guy who, and he goes and sleeps with a woman for the first time. He's married, he's got, you know, a baby on the way. And he's like, oh yeah, she was super kind, she was really nice. And there's no sense of there being, you know, they enjoy it, they get paid well. There's no sense of there being a angst or a... there being pressure which really kind of harms them in any way, or they're doing anything which harms them in any way. It's all done with such an air of triviality almost, that you don't get the sense of this inequality that they're talking about, and this oppression of certain groups, and the real things that went on in Hollywood, which just made it really odd for me, those first two episodes.
Do you know what really weirdly it brought to mind to me? You know that scene in Natural Born Killers where you see it's the Juliette Lewis being abused by her father scene, and it's shot as a sitcom with like a laugh track? And again, it's taking something really seedy and sort of slightly unpleasant and presenting it with levity so that the actual impact of it is lessened deliberately. And with this, I had the same sort of thing. You talk about, you know, the inequality. There's a scene in a sex cinema which you would have thought could have seemed a little bit seedy, and especially, you know, I won't go into the details of how he gets in there, but you know, there's a lot going on there, but actually it's really peppy, it's really upbeat, everyone's in a super good mood. Like it's almost a bit like La La Land, where you expect at some point one of them to just burst into a choreographed piece of music and start tap dancing across the screen. It's very, very strange.
I agree with everything you said. You're right, it is weirdly light. It's got a light thing going on, which I think it has to have, almost, because when these young things, these talented young things who obviously would never have actually made it in real Hollywood, start becoming successful and their dreams are becoming true, that is lovely and light. And so then when the dark things happen, actually, there are some scenes, particularly with Jim Parsons' character, he is horrible. He is a nasty piece of work. And and there are moments where you're like, oh, okay, and where what he's doing is more meticulously dissected, and tonally those scenes are dark, are properly dark and horrible, and you're like, you're feeling for his victims and how do they get themselves out of it. But then it jumps to, oh, it's all going to be lovely in the end, we'll all overcome it. And in the end, even he does stuff that helps. It's just fucked up. And yeah, I'm enjoying it. I'm confused by my reaction to it, because I mean, I'll definitely finish watching it, because it's got certain moments that are so great. There's a scene with Tallulah Bankhead and Hattie McDaniel. Hattie McDaniel won the Oscar for Gone with the Wind, which I won't spoil, in like episode 4, I think, is that's hilarious. It's brilliant. It's like, just seeing that. Again, I go back to, just give us more of that, not this whole other thing going on.
But it almost can't decide if it's a drama or if it's a satire or if it's...
No.
And it flips between the two. And I can't decide what it would be better as, because when you've got like Dylan McDermott and Patti LuPone, who fully commit to these kind of outlandish OTT roles as essentially a pimp and a wife of a studio boss, that they kind of really resonate. But for example, David Corenswet plays Jack Costello, who's this kind of wannabe leading man who's kind of beautiful and full of charisma, but he's a complete blank. And then I'm like, is he meant to be blank? Is that deliberate? Because Hollywood enjoys young men who are blank pages. But as viewers, I wanted more of a backstory, like make me care about these characters, even if essentially you're commenting on kind of how disposable everyone is in Hollywood or how superficial the entire thing is. If that is what you're doing, I still need a backstory to buy into that. But I think the point really was that I wasn't sure what I was meant to be getting from it, or what that was meant to be saying, or what the overall point was of any of it, really, because it all felt so muddled and confused. I don't think everything has to have a message, but I think your intentions have to be clear, and what people are meant to get from it has to be clear to a certain extent.
Yeah, and you're right. All the main characters are blanks, I think. All of them. All of the young, the core group who come together to make this film, basically. There's like, they're all uninteresting, I have to say. But the surrounding, supporting, and funnily enough, the series itself for long periods of time, kind of drops those guys in favor of the much more interesting older. So there's like, at one point, Mira Sorvino, who has a very famous history with Harvey Weinstein, has a brilliant scene with two older women who have ended up in positions of power almost accidentally. And that scene, I was like, this is fucking great. And you'll see it if you carry on watching it. And it almost like the series itself loses interest in those boring, blank young characters like Jack, the main guy, or Riot, and just realizes that it's much more interesting that the texture of the real people, the real Hollywood legends, is much, much more interesting than these other people. It's such a weird viewing experience.
Well, make of that what you will, but that is Hollywood, and it is available on Netflix now. Next up, we have season two of Brassic, Joe Gilgan and Danny Brocklehurst show about Gilgan's Vinny and his band of scallies as they commit petty crimes with 0 degrees of competence while trying to make ends meet. Terry, you will recall, perhaps with very little shock, loved this when it first aired on Sky last year. But Terry, does Vinny still have a place in your heart?
Oh, I still fucking love this. Like, let's just cut to the chase and not dilly-dally. But, you know, we were talking about Sky comedy shows last week when we reviewed Code 404. Which I think none of us really loved or really thought hit the mark. Now, this is an example of when they really get it right. I think it was their biggest, Sky Comedy's biggest launch to date. I think it got almost 3 million viewers for season one, which is kind of incredible. I think it's a large part down to the idea, you know, we talk a lot about authenticity, and authenticity, I think, is a word that's bandied around quite a lot, especially in telly these days, what this really is. And it's a large part down to the idea, which is just Joel Gilgan has created this gang of people in this place, and it's unlike anything you've really seen on telly before. So people compare it to Shameless, but it's really different. It's kind of a caper comedy. And this group of working class friends revolving around Gilgan's character, Vinny, and this life of kind of, you know, on the edges of the law mayhem that they exist in this kind of suburban place in the north of England, is just so compelling and so real, but also so joyful. And that's what I love about it. This is not a miserable northern kind of, you know, he does have bipolar. They're all skint. They talk about the lack of opportunity. But the brilliant thing about this, and I think it's down to the writing, really, you know, him and, as you say, Danny Brocklehurst, who's one of the great legendary British telly writers. This world that they create, you know, there's such joy and intimacy and connection between this group of people who are all kind of types and absurd. There's like a traveller. There's Tomo, the local perv with like a basement that you really wouldn't want to go down into. Michelle Keegan is this single mother with ambition and a heart. But it's the detail in these kind of scenes they sketch between them. You know, they make each other laugh more than anyone else in the world. They trust each other with their lives. They absolutely rinse each other like no one else. This kind of beautiful gang of people who you just want to be part of and would love to hang out with. So you join them about a year later, and Vinny, at the end of the last season, was on the run from a local gangster and was now hiding out in this shed, just smoking weed and pissing in a bottle, as he puts it, and has faked his own death, essentially, and is lured out by this new scam, this new plan, which revolves around a lion and them attempting to rob a travelling circus. I mean, there's a scene in a phone box where they're trying to like essentially do a hostage call for a lion that was so simple and so stupid, but had me absolutely cracking up. And what I love about the second season is it feels to me like there's a little bit more ambition. Everything feels a bit bigger and a bit bolder. There's some really great set pieces. There's an opening set piece where he's escaping from this guy. He's basically on the run from a guy, and he's like running down a ginnel and kind of falling over somebody on a mobility scooter. It's all brilliantly kind of small and northern. And there's a whole bit with a circus, but it still has that same heart. The writing, it's still really funny. Dominic West as his terribly self-obsessed, dysfunctional GP, who he sees for his bipolar condition, is just still an absolute joy. You know, he spent the most of the episodes in the first season on Tinder, and he spent most of this first episode doing an impression of an emotional support dog, which was one of the funniest things I've seen in ages. I mean, I watched the first episode and I am fully back in. I think it's got the heart, the pathos, the brilliant writing and all the chemistry of the first season.
Yes, I absolutely love it as well. I think it's just the mood of Brassic. You said it is a caper, isn't it? It's an out and out, and every episode is a caper on, you know, with the long running characters finding new ways, new ridiculous schemes and scams and escapades. It reminds me of like Steven Soderbergh is brilliant at doing these, isn't he? Like, you know, the Ocean's films with like incredible characters doing capers, and Logan Lucky, which was like more working class characters coming up with a ridiculous caper. It's got that. It's just really enjoyable, entertaining tone to it, and you love being with these characters. They're all incredibly funny and the scripts are brilliant. There's like proper funny lines of dialogue every few minutes. There's another really funny line of dialogue. I think it's great. And my MVP, I think the secret, my favorite character is Ryan Sampson's Tomo. I think Tomo is so weird and funny and bizarre, and Ryan Sampson is brilliant. I love him. He was in Plebs like for years and years and years, and he's a really funny actor. He's brilliant. He's an absolutely unique performer, and I think he's fantastic. It's just the casting of it and having Dominic West pop up, it's just really, really great show. Yeah, I love it.
See, it's funny enough, I don't remember quite what I thought of season one. I seem to recall not particularly liking it, although I don't remember exactly how much I didn't like it. So I was slightly dreading this, and going into this, all I could have in my head was, what was that? I've even forgotten the name of it. What was that show that I hated about those two boys?
Oh, and the young offenders.
Yeah, shit dairy girls. That one, yeah. I like, hated that. And I thought, God, it's giving me all these fucking things. And I was like, it's a fucking hour long, like, Christ. Like, I was not happy going into this. And yet, thoroughly enjoyed myself. And much more so, I think, than I enjoyed the only episode I saw, which was the very first one of season one. And I think because you know how I don't like stupid comedy. Like, I don't like stupid characters being stupid. I find that quite irritating. And yet, they're all so massively likable. And it's really tightly written. Like, it's just like some of the dialogue, some of the gags are really genuinely funny and also delivered perfectly. Like the bit there's a bit about whether or not it's a racist lion that genuinely made me laugh out loud, which I like. The little, you talked about the phone box sort of taken riff, that's loads of fun. There's a thing about cleaners which again I thought was fucking hilarious, and I think they're a really likable bunch of twats, to be honest, and you just go with it. And of course they're trying to rip off a circus, and at no point do you get annoyed with just the stupidity of their plan. You just go along with it because it's so much fun. Yes, this makes me actually want to watch this show, which is something I didn't really see coming. So I might actually do that. And I seem to recall, and tell me if I'm wrong, I detected on the soundtrack a hillbilly cover of Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana, which really kind of threw me.
Yeah, the music is great, by the way.
The music is good.
The music is great. But you can tell the material has been worked and worked and worked. You know how we were kind of talking about Code 404 last week, and it didn't feel like it had been worked to that degree. This, it feels like it's so tight, and every line lands, and every line is so deliberate, and you just sense that it's been like gone over and over and over and over. And that's that. I mean, I think that's what makes the writing so exceptional. There's no lazy jokes in here at all.
I'm not 100% sure that, you know, those sort of like full length runtime taking up a whole hour with ads type shows. Sometimes with sitcoms, I think it slightly labours it. Weirdly, with this one, like, because when I went into this, I thought, why is this not half an hour? It makes no sense to me that this is not half an hour. And yet, it wasn't boring. There wasn't any fat on this that I think you really could have cut. So actually, it works at this length, which I think very few of these, especially silly comedies, do work. So, I mean, certainly for my particular sensibilities, I find that you cannot sustain my attention for that period of time with silly content, and yet they managed it here. So high praise indeed from me is what I'm saying.
Silly content, I love the art.
Silly content.
Silly content.
All that silly content. Yeah. With your silly characters doing their silly things.
I think it isn't just a sitcom though. It is like there is a tradition of kind of hour long. I mean, like Mindhunter was an hour long show that was trying to be funny most of the time. And I think so. There is. It's kind of like halfway between, you know, Only Fools and Horses and Mindhunter, and I think the 45 minutes is fine. I think it works. I think it sustains, and down to the writing, it sustains that length of episode pretty much, I think.
But I remember I struggled with Green Wing for that reason, because that, I just thought, again, I thought that just felt so long for me. I was like, this is stupidity over a long period of time. 20 minutes, sure, but once you're hitting 50, I'm like, no. But yeah, this works. Brassic, Sky One, Thursday, May the 7th at 10 p.m. Boyd, would you like to run us through the also outs?
Yeah, I want to mention particularly the A-team, which is...
The A-word, surely.
Sorry, the A-team.
The A-team, which in a surprise comeback, B.A., Hannibal, Brilliant. Faison, Murdoch.
Amazing. I want to mention the A-word, which is coming back for its third series. And I think it took a while. This is the show written by Peter Bowker, who did that war drama last year that we really liked, World on Fire. This is his show about a young autistic boy. He's now 10, played by Max Vento. And it's about his parents, played by Morven Christian Lee Ingleby. And it's kind of about bringing him up and what, you know, the issues surrounding that. And... that her dad, played by Christopher Eccleston, is like, he's a kind of very kind of blundering, forthright, kind of disdainful, very funny character. It's a really underrated, I think, slightly undervalued show. I mean, it's got a big fan base, but I think probably the BBC nearly axed it after two series. Thankfully, it's back. I think probably largely for word of mouth, kind of people clamouring for their beating up. For there to be another series. It's full of brilliantly drawn characters. In a way, actually, tonally, it's not 100% dissimilar from Brassic, because it is working class people who are funny and likable and real, and to use that fucking word, authentic. And it's got, and it's really, really well written by Peter Bowker. Again, it's really finely honed. The dialogue is finely honed. Christopher Eccleston is fucking amazing in it. I think it's his best role. You know, I don't know, for a long time, and he's brilliant. So I really like the A word, and it's on Tuesday, I believe, BBC One at 9 o'clock, and I think they're putting the whole series out, all six episodes, in a box set as well.
It is indeed on May the 5th.
Yeah.
Yeah, the new season of Rick and Morty drops on E4 on Thursday at 10 p.m. Obviously, I loathe that show, so cannot recommend it. But lots and lots of people love it.
And then on the same night, that's going to double bill with Harley Quinn, which is the animated show. Animated show, which has got good reviews in America.
Yeah, which starts at 10:30.
Yeah,
Outlander, having been on Amazon, turns up on More4 on Thursday as well at 9 p.m. So lots going on Thursday.
Yeah,
and that's about it, isn't it?
And there's these isolation stories, actually, which will be interesting on ITV starting on Monday. These are the 15-minute films about the social distancing lockdown situation, written by Jeff Pope, who's like the master of the real-life crime drama, etc. He wrote Philomena, and there's Sheridan Smith in it, Robert Glenister, David Threlfall. They're going to be really, and they're on primetime ITV, just 15-minute shorts. I think they'll be really interesting. And Dead to Me season 2 starts on Netflix on Friday, which a lot of people really love. Dead to Me. I've never really got into it, but there you go.
Do we have a pick of the week?
Brassic.
Yeah, Brassic.
Yes, we have consensus. Who'd have thought? Who'd have thought a unanimous vote for Brassic? So yes, do watch that one. Before we go, a quick banshee, I feel. A quick look back at the archives of shows from the past. Who would like to kick off this week, Boyd?
Okay. I've gone for 13, which is the drama that first brought Jodie Comer to the world of television, famously.
Did I banshee this?
Did you? It's not. I checked the thing file. It wasn't on
the
there.
Spreadsheet. Wasn't on the spreadsheet.
Oh, no. Yeah. I did it as what we were watching this week, because I found it on iPlayer.
Oh, sorry.
Continue.
Okay. Yeah, 13, the thing that brought Jodie Comer to this world. I think Terry mentioned it ages ago as a thing you've been watching, but I'm banshing it because it's been a long time. And it's on BBC iPlayer, along with they put loads of box sets of really good shows on iPlayer. So all the episodes are on there. And it was an absolutely brilliant, written by Marnie Dickens. And it was all about, she played a 26-year-old who'd been imprisoned in a cellar for 13 years. She comes out the first episode, she's rescued, and then it's all about what happened, who was the captor, how does her family deal with it, what happened to the person she was in love with, her sister doesn't necessarily think it's her and wants her to take a blood test, and all of that, all the complications of what that would mean, of the situation where you're held captive for all that length of time in this horrendous traumatic situation. It was honestly, it was a fantastically well written and acted and directed series, and it's all on iPlayer 13.
I've never seen that. I would quite like to.
Watch it.
I would quite like to.
You won't regret it.
Mm, okay. Good, good, good. 13 then from Boyd. Terry, what number do you have?
Well, I'm going to irritate you by banshing a one-off feature-length documentary.
Whoa.
I know.
Hang on. Hang on.
Rule breaker.
I smell a film.
No, it's not a film. It's a definite TV documentary. It's called Rain in My Heart. Boyd will remember this. It was a 2006 documentary by Paul Watson, who was a documentary maker who essentially was credited with inventing the fly on the wall documentary. He did something called The Family in 1974, The Fishing Party in 1984, which was seen as kind of the very first examples of not reality television, but a documentary telling a very real story, a private story in a very real way. So Rain in My Heart, and I think it was actually chosen by Louis Theroux. He did a curated series on BBC and on iPlayer at one point, and he chose this as one of his documentaries. So it follows four alcoholics over the course of a year. They all live in the same place in North Kent, and it kind of follows their personal struggles. They're in and out of hospital, their relationships with their families, but also it kind of talks as much, I suppose, about these personal tragedies as it does about public health policy and those kind of things, massively affecting documentary. It is a TV documentary. It's not a film, James Dyer. So if you haven't seen it, it has been surfaced on iPlayer and it should be in the documentary section, and it is well worth your time. I think it's 90 minutes or 104 minutes. Or it's long. It's like a long thing.
See, I was hoping that you'd have a number one, and then I because I suddenly thought, oh God, what could I do? And then I suddenly thought, because I'd prepared a different one, but I thought maybe I should do six, because that's another numbered show to follow on from Boyd's 13 and do six. Do you ever see six?
And then I ruined it.
You ruined it, yeah. But I hadn't planned to do six.
What was six? Remind me what six was.
Six was it was about SEAL Team Six. Had Walton Goggins in it. It was about Navy SEALs. I think Olivia Munn joined him for the second season. It ran for two seasons. Bear in mind, this isn't my Banshee, so I'm just kind of winging this. As I recall, this is the first ones of these were directed by Leslie Linklater, who famously from Homeland. I enjoyed this. I only watched the first season. I didn't watch the second season of this, although it's on my to-watch list. So that's the one that Olivia Munn is in.
And there was the five as well, which was the first Harlan Coben one.
See, if we'd coordinated, guys, this could have been really good. We fucked it up.
Your Banshee going to be, James?
No, my actual Banshee is another one where someone has asked me to Banshee it. This is for a request from someone on Twitter, which is Star Wars Clone Wars. No, before you say, not Star Wars The Clone Wars, Star Wars Clone Wars.
Oh,
so before
God.
The Clone Wars, which is the Dave Filoni series, which has been running, which ran with sort of the it sort of predated Rebels and then Resistance, but is now back on Disney Plus for a final season. So before that came, which is the CGI sort of 3D rendered one, which started with a film. Terry's actively yawning into the microphone. She heard Star Wars and Clone Wars, like, I don't care.
Sorry, that was like a weird, like,
Pavlovian
reaction.
Response. Yeah. No, before all that, so if you cast your minds back to 2003, I want to say. Yes, 2003. Cast your mind back to 2003. Genndy Tartakovsky of Samurai Jack fame, and indeed Hotel Transylvania, did a 2D cel-shaded animation of Clone Wars that was really different in tone, and it was like they were really short. So the first two seasons, they were just 3 to 5 minutes each, the episodes were. They were really, really short. And then the third season had sort of, I think, quarter of an hour type length ones. But it introduced Asajj Ventress, which is the Sith with the twin lightsabers. And it was really fun. And I liked the tone of this more than I liked The Clone Wars. The removal of the definite article distinguishing between the two. But very few people, like loads of people know of The Clone Wars and watch The Clone Wars. But few people, even in the Empire Office, have seen, already know about Clone Wars, which is the one that predated it. So if you're a fan of The Clone Wars, I urge you to seek out Clone Wars 2003.
How many times did you just say Clone Wars?
Clone Wars. A lot of Clone Wars. I'm going to find out where it's viewing. Hang on.
But that was definitely an education in Clone Wars versus the Clone Wars.
Exactly.
I particularly enjoyed the part about the definitive article.
Yeah.
That was my favourite bit.
Thanks. I do my best. Right. It is streaming. It looks like fucking nowhere. Which is amazing.
Not even on Disney
Plus.
You
know what? I don't think it's on Disney Plus. Maybe I am wrong. But
that's ridiculous.
I can find listings for The Clone Wars. I cannot find any listings for Clone Wars, Genndy Tartakovsky's Clone Wars. That said, I'm absolutely certain you can pick it up on DVD. So if you go online, I'm sure you can find it either new or secondhand. So you can pick it up there. It's probably not very much from Computer Exchange if you want to get it there. So yeah, Star Wars, Clone Wars, know the. Right, and on that bombshell, I believe that is it for another episode of the Pilot TV Podcast. Since we are all in lockdown with endless time on our hands, it's the perfect opportunity to head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating. And while you're at it, why not follow Terry Boyd and myself on Twitter and Instagram at James C. Dyer, at Boyd Hilton, and at Terry _ White, where you'll find such treasures as images of our youthful selves and Terry's regular Instagram stories calling me a bellend. The long-awaited Picard spoiler special is now up and live on the Empire Spoiler Special account if you're already a subscriber. And if you're not, then you can sign up at glow.fm/empirefilm, where you can hear me and Patrick Stewart breaking down the key moments of that show's first season. We will be back next week with more small screen goodness, but in the meantime, if you haven't already, get thee to iPlayer and watch all 12 episodes of Normal People immediately. And if you manage to go the whole thing without crying, then take that as scientific proof that you're a Cylon. Pilot out.